I'm now joined in the studio by Sean Sherlock, Labour TD and spokesperson on Justice, Children and Youth Affairs for Cork East. And he's been in this constituency since 2007. Sean, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Will. Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be back in Youghal by the sea on a cool, cold, crisp January afternoon.
It's much nicer following the storm.
Yeah, it's looking lovely. It's looking lovely.
Indeed. Well, you're very welcome and thanks for taking time to talk to us today. Now, obviously, the election has now been called February the 8th, not that long away. But before we get into that, just tell us about your year. What challenges have you faced?
Well, it's been an extremely busy year in the Dáil and within the constituency because there are so many issues that we are working on. And so if you take the Dáil for the last year, I suppose you've had the shadow of Brexit hanging over, you know, the whole country. I think we're through a certain tunnel on that now. It's also good, for instance, that the Northern Irish institutions are
back up and running. Yeah.
I would have been a minister formerly for North-South Cooperation. I would have in the past been part of the negotiations on the Stormont House Agreement, both iterations, if you will, of that. So I'm particularly personally happy that, you know, all the parties are back around the table and, you know, a new executive has been formed. That's good news, I think, for the island of Ireland, certainly. I believe strongly that the issues that have really exercised us really are articulated by most TDs through the committee work perhaps that they do, and I'm a member of the Climate Action Committee, mm-hmm. I'm a member of the Children and Youth Affairs Committee, and
two very big portfolios in the current climate.
And I also have Justice as well, because obviously with
three
seven
very big
and I have Communications, so yes. I could talk about the National Broadband Plan as well, but with seven TDs, you know, you have to cover a much wider range.
And we
range.
Haven't got all day either.
And we haven't all day. So I think the big ticket items really over the last year, I think, you know, housing is obviously the key issue, you know, homelessness. I think transport and, you know, is a big ticket item as well. You know, the lack of infrastructure, the lack of investment in infrastructure in North and East Cork, particularly, you know, we're still waiting for, you know, the most local of roads to be done and the most national of roads to be done. You know, those are the issues that have exercised me. Climate action, I think, because I was part of the Joint Oireachtas Committee on Climate Action, and we had a very, very strong report throughout the year with 42 recommendations in relation to, you know, real and positive and pragmatic and practical solutions, you know, that we need to do on the island of Ireland in relation to climate action. But I'm one of those constituency TDs, though, that, you know, you translate the local issues into national issues. I have still a massive list of people who are looking for social and affordable homes in my constituency. When we came out of government in 2016, you know, after five tumultuous years where there is no money available, I'm still scratching my head as to why there hasn't been a massive state-led house building programme to meet the demands of those people who are on the housing list and meet the demand of those people who are looking to get on the first rung of the housing ladder. And I believe that the opportunity was there in the last 3 years to use state-owned land and get projects shovel-ready and start the ball rolling on building those houses. And
indeed, and what I'd like to do, Sean, is maybe talk about that specifically,
certainly,
maybe a little later on as well. But obviously, it's day one. Things have kicked off now. You're in full campaign mode.
Absolutely.
How's it been going today?
Well, so far so good. I mean, this will be my fifth election, but I come from a political family where my late father, Joe Sherlock, first put his name on a ballot paper in 1967. So I've lived and breathed politics all of my life.
And was he Labour?
He would have been Sinn Féin, the Workers' Party, Democratic Left, and then Labour.
Yeah,
so he would have been part of that Republican tradition that found its way into to Labour. I would consider myself still very much a, you know, a strong Republican, but that's why I'm very glad that the institutions are up and running and that we now, you know, have a devolved solution in Northern Ireland at the moment, but with the clear view of a pathway towards a fully united Ireland, you know, in the longer term. But I digress. But so I think for me, and your question relates to the campaign, I was out canvassing this morning now, and I'm one of those guttural politicians that instinctively loves campaigning because I love that interaction with people on the doorsteps.
And you get a buzz out of it.
And the people on the doorsteps, and this is the beautiful thing about this country, is they keep you honest. There isn't that distance between politicians such that you have maybe in the UK or Indeed. In mainland Europe. You know, most people have your mobile number. Most people are a WhatsApp message away from you, an email away, a Facebook message away from you, or, you know, a text message away from
Absolutely,
you.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I enjoy the robust interactions with people on the doorsteps because they keep you honest, they keep you lean.
Now, when you say robust, do you mean rude?
Well, you will have rudeness, but that goes with the territory.
It
but
does.
I honestly think that 99% of Irish people are absolutely fantastic on the doorsteps. And while they might be...
And there's a certain charm to Irish insults.
Indeed. And they might be giving you, you know, that old adage about Alex Ferguson and the hairdryer treatment. You might be getting that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you'll always walk away from a doorstep and you try to ensure that, look, if they're not voting for you, that you at least, you do them the courtesy of listening to them on the doorsteps. You might have the argument with them on the doorsteps, but you always try to be respectful on the doorsteps. And there are some people, there's never a conversation that you don't come away from the conversation having learned something. Or try to understand or empathise with the person who's on the other side of the door, who has done you the courtesy of opening the door to you, which they didn't have to do in the first instance. You're asking them for their vote. So I love, you know, that listening exercise. And if it gets heated, I love that robust debate with people. And I think Irish people like a good Barney, you know what I mean? But that you shake hands and you walk away then after that. But I look at the campaign as an exercise of touching base again with people, and it grounds you. And I think that's a wonderful thing about Irish democracy.
As a party, you're running 31 candidates.
Indeed.
And not surprisingly, I guess, you're looking to double the number of TDs you have.
The ambition would be to double from 7 to 14, you know, the number of TDs that we have. I've always said that since the 2016 election, when any smaller party goes into government, they always fare badly, you know, and it seems to be a rule of thumb in Irish politics. And I think we probably took the worst of the blame, you know, for the period when we were in government, you know, when the election of 2016
came. Some of it justified, maybe?
I honestly believe that if you look at where the country is now, I honestly think that you could arguably, by any measure, say that people are doing better. But there are still a lot of people who I would argue who have been absolutely forgotten and who continue to be forgotten, who need to have a voice and who I suspect the current government are not really targeting.
Indeed. So good on paper, but... Realistically?
Well, if you look at where we were in 2011, and then if you look at where we were in 2016, where unemployment was reducing, you know, you were beginning to kind of come out of a scenario where, you know, we no longer had the IMF or, you no longer were a programme country of the IMF, for instance. You know, we got ourselves, lifted ourselves out of those shackles. I think the longer term historical view of that government will probably be more favourable than the contemporaneous view of that government, if you will. But if you ask about Labour and Labour's prospects, I do believe honestly that there is a place for Labour within the Irish political landscape. And I think it's through voices such as my own, because I see myself as very much as a constituency politician, but I also see myself as somebody who can bring that local element on issues like childcare and climate action and housing. I know how to argue those issues, we'll say, at a national stage. And I think that's why I think you're seeing now the fact that where you have a majority government, Fine Gael government, you know, backed up by a conference and supply arrangement and a few smattering of independents, most of whom seem to be leaving the field now when
indeed.
The going is tough.
Yeah.
I think that you still need voices like the Labour Party, and it will be a slow and incremental build. That's why the target is 14 seats. But we had a very good local election and, you know, we won back a seat on Cork City Council. You know, we've our seat in Cork County Council, two seats in Cork County Council. So it's a slow, incremental progress, really. But I do believe if you ask anybody that is political who may not be supporters of the Labour Party, I think you will say that most people will maybe argue that there is always there should be a place for a party like the Labour Party, because we have brought influence to bear on successive governments that we were in, historically speaking.
And a sense of balance?
I would argue that, say, if you look at the last government, for instance, if you look at our programme going into that election, we got 90% of our manifesto actually
adopted,
implemented,
mm-hmm.
but we got only 20% of the votes, but we took 100% of the blame. And it goes back to the old adage about being the smaller party in government. You will always be blamed for everything that goes wrong. And again, I go back to the idea that what I've been doing in the last 3 years is just back on the ground hurling, meeting as many people as I can. Because sometimes when you are in government, you can become detached. And I was a minister in three departments during that time in government. Now, it was a wonderful experience in the sense of having the privilege of representing your country abroad in terms of trying to get inward investment again. But you do lose a little bit of contact with your own constituents. And the last 3 years, what I've been about is very much kind of
building,
to use that,
building those bridges again.
Building those bridges again, yeah. You know, and that's what you have to do.
Now, we've mentioned the fact that you were in coalition with Fine Gael. Now, is that likely ever to happen again? Not specifically with Fine Gael.
Well, we have we will have our, you know, manifesto, and we will, you know, set out a set of, I don't want to call them preconditions, but they are red line issues around, you know, targets around constructing social houses, targets around climate action. You know, we'll have certain what we call red line issues, which will emerge in the course of the campaign that we will have, and that if a government that if a party that approaches Labour after the election, depending on the number of seats that we get, you know, wants to do a deal with us, we will only do a programme for government on the basis of what's in our manifesto and getting 100% of our manifesto and preconditions, you know, written into
and
a programme for
government.
And
how it marries with your policies.
And how it would marry with our policies. Yeah. Like, the point, I think, that Fine Gael have been in government now for quite some time. And I think it is, but you know, fair to say that we still, if you talk to any of the candidates that will be before you over the coming weeks, the common denominator is that all of the people that are contacting them in relation to housing have been on that list possibly for more than one, more than two. In some cases, I dealt with a woman this morning who's on the social housing list for the last 10 years. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And why is it that the houses haven't been built? The other common denominator will be, you know, there will be issues like childcare, you know, for preschool kids, for instance, where, you know, there aren't enough places. We're now seeing in East Cork a situation where people going into post-primary schools don't have enough school places. There was enough money in the last 3 years to actually build houses, to build school places.
That's compounded and it hasn't as happened. Well with the insurance issues as well around
The childcare issue and the insurance costs is just like childcare facilities and preschools and creches and Montessoris, they're all now in a position where they have to go through all sorts of hoops to get accreditation from the Child and Family Agency, or TUSLA as they're called. Now their insurance costs have gone up, and they're not millionaires, these people. They're normally, you know, young people, people of, you know, older stature who've been at it for, you know, in some cases, one instance that I know, like a provider is at it for over 25 years and providing an excellent service. Now, all of a sudden, her insurance costs have just ballooned.
Yeah.
And she's had to spend money, for instance, on capital refits, you know, fire safety certs, all of that. These are all necessary things, and she didn't mind spending the money on that. But when you get a hit then, you know, for your insurance costs on top of that, you know, she's asking herself the question, why should I open my door at the start of, on 1st of January 2020, when, you know, I'm finding it hard once I pay my own staff to make a living for myself. So I think the government has lost touch with those people. And they are the people, I think, I'm not calling them the working poor, but there's a lot of people out there who are trying to pay down the mortgage, put the kids through college.
Indeed.
And if they need four tyres for the car, or if the boiler stops working, they don't have that contingency to be able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, at least all sorts of things, like be it food or fuel poverty, you know.
Absolutely. And I think this is what maybe Fine Gael have forgotten, is that there are still thousands of people out there who I would, you know, again, you don't want to label people, but who, if in the event of an emergency something happens, they just don't have the money to deal with the contingency, you know. And those are the people that I seek to represent, because I think they need a voice in the Dáil.
Now, as we mentioned earlier on, there's the, I won't say perceived, because there definitely does seem to be a lack of will or desire to do anything about the housing and the homeless situation as it stands. Having researched a few, I guess, reports that come out, it has been proven that it is certainly a lot cheaper to build it through local councils than it is through developers.
If you had a statutory housing agency that would liaise with local authorities, you can use the local authority land banks to build thousands of houses. We have a very solid record in this country of building social and affordable houses. The formula hasn't changed. The price point for, or the cost might have changed. People will say that there's a lack of skills or there's a shortage of skills in the construction sector. I believe strongly that you can always tackle that issue. I believe that's a bit of a misnomer. It's a bit of a red herring. I don't understand why, and I'm not putting blame on the local authorities, because I do believe that there's a genuine attempt by local authorities to build houses. But I think local authorities themselves have lost the skill set. Local authorities used to build houses.
Yeah.
They no longer do, but they have land banks. Now, there's the money is there to build houses. The land is there to build houses. Why in the name of goodness have we not built the types of houses that need to be built in this country? And I believe that there is an ideological reason for that, and I believe that Fine Gael are ideologically opposed to the state investing in housing, because I believe ideologically that Fine Gael believe that it should be left to the market.
Yes.
We now have a situation where we're spending over, I'd say conservatively, €1 billion per annum, conservatively paying landlords rent allowance. And that is a false economy, because if you could take somebody who is in private rented accommodation, who's getting rent allowance or a HAP payment, a housing assistance payment or whatever it is, if you could take them out of that house, put them into a state-built house and at the same time build affordable houses, you're releasing such pent-up demand and you're meeting the unmet, you know, the dire need for social housing. And you could do that in a very short space of time. But I don't believe that there's a strong political willingness on the part of this government at present to do that, because I think instinctively Fine Gael do not have the finger on the touch with ordinary people who require these houses, and I believe that they're too far removed and divorced from them.
And so how does a council wrench back control?
You need a strong minister in the first instance. You need a strong Taoiseach, and you need a strong Taoiseach who sets targets right across his cabinet for any number of issues. But on housing, the Taoiseach calls in the local authority people. You have a state finance agency that finances the building of houses. You put it out to tender. I guarantee you that there are any number of building companies out there and construction companies who, if there were 30 or 40 houses coming up tomorrow, for instance, in the town of Youghal or wherever in East Cork,
they'd all be applying.
They would be applying.
Yeah.
Because you'd be handing it back turnkey, and you'd be agreeing the price beforehand. And what it would allow the construction company to do, for instance, is to say, look, I know what's on my books now for the next 24 months or 36 months.
Exactly, yes.
I have, and it allows the construction company actually to take that to the bank if they want to leverage then for further building projects in the private sphere. So there is a way of doing this. But I don't believe it comes down to a lack of ideas. I believe it comes down to ideology at this stage. I'm convinced of that.
Yeah. Well, in 1975, there were scarce resources in Ireland, the local authorities built just under 9,000 homes. And in 2018, in a so-called boom, we built 800.
Yes. And what we were doing then, what the Fianna Fáil government at the time said was, let's do what we call Part 5. So the private builder comes in, this is your 20 acres and, you know, forgive me if I don't recall fully the formula, was it a certain percentage are social and then a certain percentage are affordable. And that's what the government of the day was relying on for the provision of social housing. That was not a sustainable formula. What wasn't done was the demographic study of where the unmet need would be coming into the 2000s, if you will. And so there was a lack of foresight, if you will, in relation to that. So, sorry, I meant if you're coming, you know, the bust was 2007. There was a glut of houses in the private sector, but the social housing program stopped. Because there was a perception that whatever ghost estate was going to be repaired eventually, that you could meet your demand from that ghost estate or from, you know, the bigger estates where houses were unsold or where houses were taken back by banks, for instance.
Or
went into NAMA. Yeah, yeah. Okay. And so what there needs to be now is an absolute, and I think this has to be cross-party. I think it has to be non-partisan, because I think the issue is too important.
Absolutely.
I think it's an issue now where we all as politicians have lists as long as your arms in relation to people who need houses. And Irish people believe in social housing. How many people do we know that came out of council houses? I came out of a house, for instance, where my late father was a sugar factory worker. A bunch of the workers came together. They were able to lease land off the Irish Sugar Company, or now Greencore, mm-hmm. and they got together and they built houses.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why you can't go down to that community or back to that kind of community philosophy again.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and that kind of energy, that's what it will take.
That has to be cross-party, because, you know, you're talking about homeless people here.
Indeed. And there isn't a whole pile of difference between, say, Labour or Sinn Féin or even Fianna Fáil or the Social Democrats when it comes to how you do that. You see, and that's the point. There's a lot actually that unites politicians. There's more that unites politicians mm-hmm. in terms of looking at an issue. There might be different emphasis on how you get your destination. But you can find agreement. And I always use the example of Northern Ireland. If you can fashion a Northern Irish agreement that gets, you know, five or six disparate views or disparate parties around who are absolutely opposed to each other around the table again to govern, you know, there's no reason why we can't use that same philosophy to tackle issues like housing in the 26 counties.
Indeed. I can't disagree with it.
Okay.
Now, climate change, a massive big topic as well, not just in Ireland, but around the globe, really. You know, you also have your policies on that as well.
We do. I'm very fortunate to be a member of the Climate Action Committee. And you'll recall when the Citizens Assembly met, it came up with a set of recommendations. And the Dáil then took those recommendations and we all came together. Again, this is a spirit of cross-party cooperation where you had the people before profit, ourselves, Sock Dems, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. We came up with a set of 42 recommendations. And we believe that 42 recommendations is a good template for the government of the day to take up and say, right, we're going to go with these in terms of how we tackle climate change. What we really, the way I think of climate change in this country is that if we're to meet the so-called 2030 targets and 2050 targets, mm-hmm. and if we're to do our part to stop, you know, the increases in temperature that we're seeing,
2%.
The 2%, we have to keep it within mm-hmm. 1.5 degrees Celsius, you know, by 2030 and so on. Well, then I believe that the way to do that is to ensure that there's a set of policies that are not outlandish or mad, but that are practical. And the first key one is retrofitting houses. We think that you can retrofit 75,000-80,000 houses a year. Because it comes back to my local experience, the amount of houses that I go into where somebody has literally the bag of blocks outside the front door and they're shoveling, you know, very often in poor health, shoveling coal and shoveling wood into a back boiler to keep the whole house going.
Mm-hmm.
And if you came in and you retrofitted that house, that person would, number one, their quality of life would increase dramatically. Number two, we'd be taking carbon out of society. We'd be meeting our targets. And in the long term, that person would be a happier person. They'd have a nicer house. And the way to do it is to actually just create a block of finance to do it. You take all of the every social house that there is in the country or in the county of Cork. You look at which houses are fuel impoverished, because it comes down to fuel poverty. Which houses are fuel impoverished? You have a massive state-led program that says we are going to target X amount of houses in Youghal or Killa or Castlemarte or wherever over a period of time. You say we're going to go in, we're going to completely retrofit your house. All of a sudden, that person has a house that they're not, you know, relying on a back boiler, or where they're not going to, you know, waiting for the coal man to come.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe that the coal man will continue to exist for a long time to come. I believe that we'll continue. You know, I'm not going to be a hypocrite about this. I have the fuel. I have the stove at home. And we all like the fire, I think, in Ireland. I think we're attuned to the idea of the fire. I'm not talking about taking fires out of the equation. But what I'm talking about is allowing people who are living in fuel poverty the opportunity to have a better home to live in and do it in a way that takes out carbon at the same time, or certainly reduces carbon. So again, it comes down to the practical and the pragmatic. The government is saying that they're going to get rid of diesel engines within the next 10 years. I think myself that that's unrealistic. I think what the government is doing there is, again, it's ideological. They're saying that the market is going to deal with this within the next 10 years. Personally, I think that, you know, from talking to, I've had discussions with Toyota about this, actually, ironically enough, or coincidentally enough, and they feel strongly that perhaps there will be a transition over the next 5 to 10 years towards, you know, the hybrid, and then after that, who knows where the technology will be. And if you talk to somebody in Yall now who has to travel to Cork to work, for instance, that person is not going to go fully electric because you've got range anxiety, you don't know when you're going to be able to charge your car, you know, you don't know what the battery life is going to be.
We just don't have that infrastructure.
So I think there has to be a transitional arrangement, but you have to incentivize people as well. And, you know, we all agree that nobody wants to be driving a diesel car if the alternative is a fully electric car. But I'm not going to make the switch to a fully electric car at 38,000 euros or 40,000 euros. Why should I, or why should anybody, if I'm not going to be sure that I have the security that I can make my journey from A to B, and that
without
without getting stressed out, you know?
So absolutely,
we need to be practical and pragmatic in terms of what we do. I'm one of the people then, and I'm just conscious that we are in Yall by the sea. I championed the microplastics legislation. I had a bill, Grace O'Sullivan, actually, our next door neighbour over in Waterford, started a bill when she was in the Senate about getting rid of microbeads, for instance, the microplastics that are seeping into the ocean, that are coming into the food chain now. Her bill failed. I took up the cudgel on that, fully acknowledged the Greens in relation to them starting the ball rolling, but kept my bill on the table and told Owen Murphy, the minister, I said, I'll keep my bill on the table and I will get it through all stages. I'm confident of that until such time as the government introduces a bill, which they did, and we now are moving in this country to banning microbeads. Now, that's an area where you have, you know, that's government and all parties working together on a societal issue that takes off the party political hats.
Which, as you said, should include the homeless and the housing.
Absolutely. Yep. These are what you call existential issues that we all agree should be sorted.
From a humane and a societal point of view.
That's the key. Yep. That is the key word, from a humane and societal point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you mentioned there about retrofitting houses to make it a greener economy and to cut down on our carbon output, etc. Is this all part of your carbon budget?
One of the 42 recommendations of the Climate Action Committee's report was that you would agree with the trajectory of carbon tax over a longer period of time, up to the 80 euros per tonne. We're being honest about that, you know. But what you would do is you would ring fence it. Because right now, all taxation goes into the Exchequer and Pascal Donoghue basically controls it. What the committee said, and this includes... Sinn Féin had a different position and the people before Profit had a different position. But the Greens, ourselves, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, agreed that yes, you have a carbon price, but if you're taking in carbon tax, you ring fence it and you put it back out to those very people who are fuel impoverished. You also then ensure that where somebody's in receipt of fuel allowance, that there is a commensurate increase in the fuel allowance to reflect the cost of the carbon tax, if you will, for those who are most fuel impoverished. So that would involve people who are, we'll say, reliant on either a pension payment or a social protection payment, so that you offset the cost of a carbon tax increase for those people. Now, the government haven't done that. They haven't done that. This is where the all-party committee said, agreed in the majority, we're agreeable on a carbon tax, but it has to be ring-fenced. And we believe strongly that if you ring-fence it, you've a guaranteed revenue. It allows you to bring revenue back into towns like Yall. It allows you to retrofit those houses where we all know those houses. We know the people who are living in the houses because they're our neighbours. And very often they are older people whose houses are probably in need of, you know, they might want to hold on to the back boiler because, you know, but they might need a better home. You use the money to help those people through grant aid, through the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland, or through a local authority grant, or through, you know, maybe CCAD acting as agents to work with those to improve...
To facilitate that work.
To improve those people's houses.
You know, we talk about this 2% ceiling. I think that equates to about 450 parts per million, which is a dangerous level. In 22 years' time, before way before 2050, we will have reached that dangerous level.
Absolutely. And regardless of what politicians in Australia are saying, the reality is Australia is burning.
Yeah.
And even if you look at the map of Australia, because this articulates the point that you're making about the percentage increase. If the planet keeps heating up, if you have more bushfires, Australia is massive, and the bushfires, you can pick out where the bushfires are. But now what we're seeing is the effect of the bushfires, the smoke from the bushfires. And you look at Melbourne, where the tennis, I'm not a tennis fan, but the tennis championship.
It's been delayed.
It's been delayed. Yeah. You know, that's the most recent up-to-date example as we're talking here in the studio, where now the smoke from those fires is now reaching South America. So I don't think we should, for a moment, ignore that. Because there will be some similar incident in the Northern Hemisphere, and it will have an effect on Ireland. Now, rising sea levels is the big item.
Yep.
So you have rising sea levels, you have people, like we rely on our maritime industry, our fishing industry. You will have changes in behaviour in relation to the consumption of fish if we continue to have heating waters. We don't know what effect that's going to have on biodiversity, on fish life. That has an effect on livelihoods, for instance. And our coastal communities would certainly be affected by that. It may be incremental, but it will certainly happen. I have two young boys. I have, you know, 2.5 and 8 months. And I don't want to sound like your typical politician giving you platitudes. But if my generation of politicians don't work to try and solve this crisis now, I fear for their future, you know. And I think there are some politicians who think that this is, you know, this is part of, this is God's will. You know, if you were a Healy Ray, you might be thinking it's God's will. There are some of us who are more, let's say down to earth and scientific in our analysis who can see the evidence of it. And if you talk to fishermen, they'll tell you the evidence of it. If you talk to farmers, they'll tell you the evidence of it in changes in weather patterns. You know, look at the storm surges that we're experiencing on our own Atlantic coasts,
Indeed.
The frequency of storms. So that suggests to me that like we will have commitments, but the industrial north, if you're talking in global terms, we'll have to do something about ensuring that we get CO2 emissions down, because we have to give the next generation at least a fighting chance.
Indeed, you know. Indeed. As a last major topic, I guess, just like to touch on the health service. Record people on lists, record people on trolleys, people dying on trolleys, people in the corridors. Shameful.
It's shameful. And again, it's a solvable issue. If you had more beds, you can... what they call triage more people through the system. I hate this expression that they're using at the moment, bed blockers. I think it's an awful, unfortunate term. I think it needs to be weaned out of the language, because you have some who are blaming, you know, older people invariably who are waiting for step-down beds in nursing homes and they're taking up beds and they're called beds. I think it's an awful way to describe any human being. If somebody's in a hospital, they're in a hospital because there is a need for the bed.
Yep.
And there shouldn't be any reason why in a modern society, you know, they're saying that there's a recruitment crisis in relation to the number of consultants and nurses. But the INMO have suggested solutions to this, have suggested ways in which you can do this. And I know nurses personally, as you do, we all know nurses within our communities who've now stepped back from the contracts that they're under and have either gone agency nursing or gone into, you know, maybe GP surgeries because the stress and strain...
Or emigrated.
Mm-hmm. I strongly believe that, okay, if you've got a program for government and if you've got national pay agreements, I suppose government will want to make sure that everybody is on the same page, and they won't want to pay nurses an increased premium in particular areas of society where you need, where there's a massive need or demand for sectoral employment, like nursing,
frontline services.
You put it well. In terms of frontline services, no politician that I know of would disagree to the idea that you would incentivise those nurses who are in Dubai or Australia to come home if the packages that you could provide them. You'd get more nurses onto the wards and you'd have a greater throughput, I think, of patients. I have never been able to crack the consultant's code of a MRTA, but I don't understand the politics of how consultants work. If you have a public and a private structure, you can't have a situation where somebody could be perceived to be holding on to beds for a private patient if it means that over a weekend, for instance, that bed could be empty. And in hospitals, I don't know how many empty beds there are in CUH at the moment. I know for a fact that there are empty beds in Limerick. Why is that?
Indeed.
And I haven't been able to crack that code, because if you've empty beds, it means that there are still people outside either on a trolley or on an accident and emergency. Now, there's no reason why you can't get a person into a bed and triage them in the bed. And you're shifting the protocol away from triage, triage trolley and then bed when it's available.
You're taking them out of a corridor. Yeah.
Well, get the person into a bed and then you can start triaging them. You know, but look, I don't want to tread on medical practice here because I know nothing about medical practice. But I'm just saying that, again, we have the bricks and mortar. There should be enough beds in the system. And there should be a way of using hospitals like Bantry, like Mallow, where you could have empty beds to actually get people out back into these hospitals, for instance, while you're getting people who are coming in the front door into bed. So I don't believe it's money. I believe in relation to nurses that you need to incentivize. So that does involve money. But I think it's about changing practices as well in relation to how the HSC operates. And I do believe strongly that if you open more beds, the answer is more beds. More beds means more people going through the hospital, means you can take more people to the accident and emergency. You send them home if they need to be sent home, or you send them onto the bed if they need the bed. And I can't understand why that hasn't happened. And I think, I don't want to dwell on it too long, I'm conscious of time here as well. Again, we just have to start thinking laterally about how we find solutions and confidence motions in ministers. Yeah, you take a minister off, you put his head in the chopping block and he's gone, but you haven't solved the problem of the health services. So I know we're very good in Ireland.
No, but one would hope that someone who did have that lateral thinking would come in.
Well,
that's the whole idea, really.
But you're still left with the same set of problems. I think that, there was a Sláinte Care report, which was a cross-party report with a set of recommendations in relation to how you would deal with primary care, tertiary care, secondary care, and that hasn't been implemented. And that's yet another example of how, when it all comes together with a report, the ideas in the report are never taken up by the government of the day.
The election is on the 8th. Is Brendan Howland the man to make Labour relevant again?
I think the premise of the question is wrong, if I could say that respectfully. To make Labour relevant again, I think, does a disservice to the people, the thousands of people who actually did cast their vote, who are citizens, who casted their vote for Labour in the first instance at the last election.
But I understand that, and I would throw that in because
their vote is a valid vote.
There have been wilderness years for the past 4 years, maybe, for Labour.
Let me deal with the premise of the question first, and I will answer the question, absolutely. If a party has a mandate in Dáil Éireann, whether it has one seat or 55 seats, I think it is relevant. Whether you're an independent, I think because you're relevant, because the people have put you there and given you that mandate. So I do believe that the Labour Party is relevant. And I've just outlined, for instance, examples of how people like me have influenced committee reports as a Labour member, giving voice to issues like climate change and ensuring that the just transition becomes part of that, for instance, where workers who are moving from carbon sourced industries into green industries, that you have to have a just transition. That's where Labour are relevant in terms of, we've influenced the equality agenda. In the last programme for government that we were part of, you wouldn't have had a referendum on marriage equality, from Fine Gael at that time, but Eamon Gilmore was leader who put it in there. So we've always found a way of being progressive, and if we are part of a government, to stitch into programme for governments various pieces that continue that progressive agenda of Irish society, ultimately. So I think there is a place for Labour. Brendan Howland is leader. There's no question about his leadership. I believe strongly that our own manifesto is one that's based on pragmatism and practical mm-hmm. solutions to the housing homelessness. We have a robust housing policy, you know, and we're not trying to steal the Greens' clothes on green policies, because I think a lot of us are instinctively at that point now anyway, politically.
Where everyone has to be.
Where everyone has to be, if you will. You know, so what I want to do is I want to work with progressive people, if I'm elected, and I hope I will be elected to Dáil Éireann, and, you know, for instance, in the town of Youghal, you know, people like Mary Lennon Foley, you know, does a stellar job. If Mary is elected to the Dáil, I would be reaching out my hand to Mary Lennon Foley and saying, come on, let's work together, and how can we help each other? And that's the type of politician I am. I'm more collaborative. I can be combative when I need to be, but I'm more collaborative than I am. You know, I'm not partisan, you know, and I think that's where we need to be in politics nowadays. We have to be reaching out to other politicians, other parties, because the agendas are just too important to ignore at this stage.
Indeed. No, that's fantastic. I've no doubt, Sean, that we will speak again as well over the next few weeks as well. That would be really good too as well. And in the meantime, thanks ever so much, and I wish
you
every
success.
Thank you
so much for having me, Will. I'm delighted.
Thank you, Sean.
Here.